Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Help wanted. Must be reasonably high profile, easily confirmable in a hostile Senate, and handy with both global crises and domestic budget cutting. Applications accepted, care of the Pentagon. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 24th of November. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The announcement came from St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney Robert McCullough as we went to air this evening. A grand jury in St. Louis County has decided not to indict Officer Darren Wilson for the shooting of Michael Brown this summer in Ferguson, Missouri. The announcement came after a very long day of waiting and uncertainty in a city that has been waiting for this decision for 100 days now. We'll have a bit more on this story at the end of the broadcast. But first, the personnel news out of the White House this morning. Chuck Hagel. To be fair to Mr. Hagel, the job description has changed quite a bit since he became Secretary of Defense a bit more than a year and a half ago. The brief back then, when he got the job, February of last year, was to help the Pentagon transition away from the decade-long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and shrink the defense budget in the meanwhile. And then came Syria and ISIS and Afghanistan all over again. So we sent Marketplace's Adam Allington off to find out what kind of skill set the defense secretary wanted might include this time round.
Wanted, defense secretary, must have experience managing large organizations, overseeing shrinking budgets, dealing with conflict at home and abroad. Military experience, a plus, but not necessary. That's what Winslow Wheeler of the Project on Government Oversight says President Obama should be looking for.
He needs somebody who understands how the Pentagon needs to be reformed in terms of his acquisition process, and then have the skill and spine to actually make it happen.
Wanted, executive skilled at managing up. Wheeler says his ad would include something like ability to advise on fast-moving crises like ISIS, Ebola, or Ukraine.
Pushback on policy issues to help the president sort through the difficult decisions he has to make.
Others say the job posting should also include one pretty large caveat: position temporary.
So this man or woman who comes in is really going to be more of a caretaker than a game changer.
Larry Kolb is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and served as assistant defense secretary under Reagan. He says it's unlikely the new defense secretary will have much power until after the next presidential election, but he says many of the traditional skills still apply.
Some military experience, particularly ground combat, who knows what it's like when you put men and women in harm's way and in trying to do this nation building. I think you would want someone who has management experience, whether in the public sector or the private sector.
Additionally, Kolb says navigating the political side of the job is still really important, something he says Chuck Hagel never fully recovered from following a withering confirmation process at the hands of his fellow Republicans. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
President Obama's announcement last week on immigration policy is going to make its way through the economy in a whole bunch of different ways. There are going to be better paying jobs for undocumented immigrants, no longer worried about deportation, economic mobility for millions of people, among them students, especially those with parents who are here without papers. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
In-state tuition, driver's licenses, work-study jobs, and internships, these are a few of the things that could help undocumented immigrants who want to go to college or grad school. Michael Olivas, who teaches immigration law at the University of Houston, says you may also see workers going into professional programs to become
doctors, lawyers, teachers, architects, pharmacists, etc., because many of them just hadn't been able to afford it before.
The new policy won't mean a flood of new students, says Michael Fix, president of the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. Those new students still won't qualify for federal financial aid, or they're already eligible for in-state tuition in some places. Also, the policy mostly applies to the parents of children who were born here or have legal status. But that's almost 4 million parents, and their kids could get a big boost in school.
If you remove some of the stress in these families, and if you increase the incomes, which you could see among some of the U.S. citizen children, is more persistence in school, maybe better grades, and you might see better health.
A recent study found that children in families under the threat of detention or deportation end up with less education than children of citizens. Lily Farhang led the study at Human Impact Partners. She says now parents can be more involved at school.
Undocumented parents are really struggling with poor job conditions, with economic hardship and stress, and it can limit their participation in learning activities. And in providing resources like, you know, as simple as access to books and toys that can help promote a child's development.
Lorella Praley is director of advocacy with the United We Dream Network. She didn't find out she was undocumented until her senior year in high school, but her sister knew much younger.
I could see how it affected her so much in both how she performed in school and in how she related to others.
Praley's sister qualified for deferred action under a program 2 years ago for young people whose parents brought them here illegally. Praley now has her green card, so under the new policy, their mom will qualify too. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
More record highs in stocks today, or as Wall Street likes to call it, Monday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been asking a pretty basic question the past couple of months. What does the economy feel like to you? Is it better? Still stuck? Same old, same old? The answers we've gotten have come from all over the country and from people in all kinds of jobs. Today, a story that starts in Savannah, Georgia, and ends, more than 2,000 miles away.
My name is Beth Rogers. I live in Phoenix, Arizona. I have a master's degree in accounting, and I am a CPA. During the last 4 years, I lost my job, I lost my home, I had surgery 2 times, and I had to take a job paying 40% of what I was making, and I had no benefits. I was making about what I made in 1994. I was way overqualified, and I hated the job, and I hated the company I worked for. Then I lost that job. I was unemployed for almost 4 months. I didn't know how I was going to pay my next month's rent. I borrowed money from friends and family to feed my kids. I went to a food bank for the first time in my life. My kids and I were about to be homeless. My new employer paid to relocate me here to Phoenix. Now, I work for a great company here. I have a great boss and love my job. My salary is less than what I was making before the recession, and I don't think I will ever make that much money again. But I can pay all my bills and provide a decent life for my kids. My personal economy is much better. Now I can see a light at the end of the tunnel.
That was Beth Rogers from Phoenix, Arizona. If you take a minute and tell us how the economy feels to you, maybe we'll get you on the radio. You can do that at marketplace.org. This is going to be a big week for people in the oil business. And yes, I know we've been talking about oil a lot lately, but here's the thing. OPEC meets in Vienna on Thursday amid speculation that crude could fall to $60 a barrel, $60 a barrel, unless the cartel cuts production. That's 60 bucks. It'll make filling up the minivan cheaper, but it might not be such good news for a whole bunch of other people in this economy. And in fact, there is a chance it could end up being bad news for all of us down the line. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has more.
The oil boom has produced one big set of winners outside of the oil business, the whole economies of states like North Dakota and Texas. Economist Michael Greenstone runs the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago.
The places where the booms have been occurring have largely benefited from big increases in land and housing prices. They're now going to give some of that back.
When oil prices collapsed all of a sudden in the late 1980s, it blew back on the rest of us. Michael Weber is deputy director of the Energy Institute at the University of Texas. He says, first, oil producers in Texas and Oklahoma went bankrupt.
Which caused a lot of land deals to go bad because land had been overvalued, which caused tens of thousands of savings and loans to go bankrupt and belly up, which caused a nationwide S&L scandal and eventually led to recession.
Weber says that particular set of dominoes isn't likely to fall this time, but it's an example of what can happen. And there's this. Nobody knows for sure that we're looking at a long stretch of low oil prices. Maybe we're looking at a stretch of volatility, prices that go up and down. That can slow the economy down, says MIT energy economist Christopher Knittel. He starts with a household example. Gas prices are high, so a family buys a Prius instead of an SUV.
Now, if oil prices fall, then they wish they had bought the more powerful car instead of the more fuel-efficient car.
But it's too late. The money's been sunk. Companies, too, can get caught with the wrong big-ticket items. Airlines, railroads, shippers.
When they bet wrong, then that means their prices have to increase, and we pay those prices.
Finally, low gas prices could have another cost. More driving, more carbon emissions, more global warming. I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
All right, so that's pricing. Let's talk about production for a second now, because high-cost oil producers are really feeling the pinch of those prices. And by high-cost producers, I mean us. The new oil that we are pumping in this country comes from shale, which we get out of the ground by fracking, which is awfully pricey, you could say. You sink millions of dollars into a high-tech well, and within a year or two, the gusher that you had becomes a trickle. Energy types call that the decline rate. Scott Tong from the Sustainability Desk has our explainer.
The notion of oil wells tailing off and aging isn't new. In the late 50s, a Hollywood celebrity famously joked that actors are, quote, about as short-lived as an oil well and twice as pretty. The issue is, for the new so-called shale wells, production falls like a stone in the first year. Jim Burkhardt is with the consultancy IHS Energy.
Let's say you produce 500 barrels in the first month of production. 12 months later, you could be producing around 250 barrels, so a decline rate of about 50%. In a conventional well, the decline rate is much less steep.
Why? The new oil is not a pool of liquid. It's trapped in tight rock, so you have to fracture or frack it to get the oil out. But then it slows down, the pressure falls, and you have to do it again, which is expensive. It's $8 million per well in many places, and Ed Herz in Houston isn't sure it's worth it.
I've seen it personally, firsthand.
He's with oil and gas from Hill House Resources, and he teaches economics at the University of Houston.
We've had wells on production since 2009, 2010 that have been plugged and abandoned here in 2014 because they are not producing enough to cover their cost.
His firm barely profited in shale, so it went back to old-school conventional oil, where a good well returns $5, even $10 for each one invested. Fracking for shale oil, he says, is a fad. It's like that scene on a cruise ship.
They all ran to the shale side of the boat. That was the fashion of the day. We see this in other industries as well.
Another thing about fast-declining wells, before one tails off, you have to drill the second. And then before that tails off, you have to drill the third. It's a treadmill. And it may be speeding up as the most productive spots get taken. Some call this the Red Queen race. Remember Alice from Wonderland? Well, in the sequel, she runs and she runs and she runs and she gets nowhere. At which point, the Red Queen chimes in.
Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that.
Constant drilling means constant spending, and revenues are not keeping up. So shale investors are edgy. Analyst Virendra Chowan is with Energy Aspects in London, speaking by phone.
If you're giving money to somebody, you eventually want to get something back. If that's not happening, then there seems to be something wrong with the business model.
To which shale optimists say, hold on. If you look back, drilling technology has repeatedly proven skeptics wrong for a century now. Again, Jim Burkhardt at IHS Energy.
Until we hit peak knowledge, until the human race hits peak knowledge, we won't hit peak oil supply.
Companies today now drill and frack wells deeper, closer together, more efficiently. So, can technology improve faster than shale wells tail off? Geologist Alan Gilmer heads the firm Drilling Info.
If today the wells you're drilling are twice as good as the wells you drilled 2 years ago, then that goes a long way towards addressing that decline.
Today, the U.S. produces more than 3 million barrels per day from shale alone. That's more than the total output of Iran or Iraq or Venezuela.
I think it's very unlikely to ramp down unless operators really start pulling back on drilling. And as long as a well is economic, I don't see that happening.
Ed Hers at Hillhouse Resources does. With oil prices low and investors antsy, exuberance could go bust.
The challenge with these fast declining wells is this pace of drilling needs to continue. Without the pace of drilling continuing, that 3.5 million barrels a day will peter out to zero in the next 3 to 5 years.
And that's the debate. Will shale oil decline the way its wells do, the way movie stars come and go? Bullish types will note the actor who compared short careers to oil wells. His name was Ronald Reagan. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One more name for you, the voice of the Red Queen there, by the way, Marlena Chertok from our Washington Bureau. Coming up, celebrity earnings post-mortem.
Death ushers in lawyers, accountants, and executors, and they usually bring a cold eye for maximizing revenue.
Of course they do. Our series, I've Always Wondered, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 7 points on this Monday. That's less than a 10%. Closed at 17,817. The NASDAQ climbed 41 points, 9/10%. Finished things at 47.54. The S&P 500 up 5 points, 3/10%. 2069. Retailers rallied today. Best Buy, the world's biggest electronics chain, sparked up 2.3%. The clothier Urban Outfitters donned 5.3% today. Luxury accessories retailer Coach rolled up 2.3%. Two big automakers gained today. Electric car maker Tesla drove up 1.6%. It is in talk with Germany's BMW about collaboration on battery technology and lightweight materials. BMW beamed up 1.4% on the news. Beamed up, get it? Beamer? Beamer? All right. Anyway, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its second estimate for third quarter gross domestic product. The Conference Board issues its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And you can call him Jolton Joe or the Yankee Clipper. Baseball great Joe DiMaggio was born 100 years ago on November 25th, 1914. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Black Friday, which, as you probably know, somehow starts on this Thursday, will, it is safe to assume, be much like all the Black Fridays of yore. Long lines, big savings, and then more long lines. But the demographics of that crowd in line might be a bit different this year. Younger. Specifically, Macy's is making a bet on millennials. Terry Agins is a retail fashion writer, and she's also the author of the book Hijacking the Runway. Terry, it's good to have you on.
Hi, glad to be here, Kai.
So let me ask you, as we head into the oh-so-important holiday season, what is your gut telling you about retail and consumers and how that whole smash the next 6 weeks or so is going to go?
Yeah, well, it's always a fight to the finish as we get through the season. But my sensibility is that I think the shoppers are going to go out there and spend as they always do. But there will be, you know, a few trends that they'll pick up here and there. There'll be the doorbusters. And, of course, retailers will come up with, you know, all kind of gimmicks to get people shopping.
Let me ask you about that granddaddy, really, of American retailers, certainly at the holiday times. Macy's, what do they have to do over the next couple of months to make this really successful for them as sort of a bellwether in American department stores?
Yeah, well, Macy's has been very clever over the last few years as department stores consolidated. Macy's ended up with 850 stores, $28 billion of sales. And, you know, they are the big Goliath. And what they've done really cleverly is they have targeted the millennials. And these are people from the ages of 13 to 30. Mm-hmm. This is the key demographic who they are really going after. And they've been very smart. Part of their strategy has been getting a lot of celebrity brands in the store, mm-hmm. like fragrances and also other exclusives. And it's been a way to actually engage this young consumer group to make them interested in department stores again.
You know, it's funny, though, because until they renovated it recently, the Macy's flagship store in Herald Square in New York was a little bit fusty. You know what I mean? I mean, it didn't have millennial vibe.
Not at all. I mean, it was a store that just had a lot of stuff in it. And the one thing that Macy's did is they figured out that they really needed to make the store exciting. I mean, when you have a store that has an excitement, for example, all the celebrity fragrance launches that they've done in the past, starting with, you know, J-Lo and Taylor Swift and Rihanna, Lauren Conrad, that actually brings a lot of excitement in the store.
Wow, really?
Yes, and all this plus the new brands that they brought in, they've got a brand with Madonna, and this is something that's made the store, given the store a lot of buzz, and it competes with the same kind of buzz that you get at some of the fast fashion stores.
The idea, though, that a fragrance by Lauren Conrad is going to get people in the store, I don't know.
Well, the thing is that, Kai, now remember, even if the young people come in there and just come and smell the tester, and they might not even buy the fragrance, the thing is they're through that threshold, and that's what's so important. Because once they get in the store, they're going to end up looking around, wandering around, and seeing all the new displays, and they'll perhaps buy something else. And so that's certainly what Macy's did when they introduced the Justin Bieber fragrance.
Oh, come on. No, is there a Justin Bieber? There was a Justin Bieber fragrance? How did I miss that?
Yeah, Justin Bieber, that launch was really important in bringing in those young millennials. And that was when they started actually opening the store on Black Friday at midnight. And all that was designed to get in those young people. They showed up. And, you know, the kids went shopping.
Listen, before I let you go, are you one of those Black Friday shoppers? Are you going to be at the front door of some store at 4 o'clock in the morning?
No, I am not one of those. Right. I think that whole frenzy of getting up early and getting to the store is a lot of fun for some people, and it becomes a big game and a big racket. But not for me. I'm an armchair shopper.
Amen. Terry Hagan, she writes for the Wall Street Journal. Her most recent book is called Hijacking the Runway. Terry, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
I know this is tough to wrap your brain around, but there are, in fact, some questions out there that cannot simply be Googled. Queries about business and the economy that you ask and we answer. It's our series called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blatant.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has today's installment.
Listener David Rigby works as an actuary in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and the number cruncher in him wanted to know this.
We hear about the vast amounts made by the estates of deceased celebrities like Michael Jackson and Elvis Presley. Who enjoys the benefit of all this income, and does the government get any tax revenue from it?
I called dead celebrity lawyer Mark Rossler. His client list is like a who's who at the Hollywood Cemetery. James Dean, Ella Fitzgerald, John Belushi. When one of these stars checks out, Rossler checks in, valuing what's left.
They have two types of assets. They have tangible assets. They're cars, bank accounts, homes.
Zillion-dollar homes like Neverland and Graceland.
And then they have intangible assets, copyrights, trademarks, what they call the right of publicity, which is the right to your name and likeness.
Rossler says for the heirs, this is where the big money usually is. It's the songs sold on iTunes, played in bars, and used in ads.
You're the Pepsi generation.
Plus the celeb's name and image to put on products and even appear on stage in holographic form. Now let's see who inherited the realm from one of our most lucrative dead celebrities, the King of Pop.
I'm going back to Indiana, back to where I started from.
In his will, Michael Jackson went all the way back to his childhood. His mom got a big piece of the action, along with his three kids. His siblings, including the other four Jacksons, and his dad didn't get a thing. Now, when Jackson died in 2009, he didn't have much value to marketers after all the scandals he'd faced. Plus, he had massive debts. But Beverly Hills entertainment lawyer Joseph Schleimer says death brings, as it were, a change in management.
The mansions, yachts, luxury cars, private jets, and parasitic entourages are dispensed with. Death ushers in lawyers, accountants, and executors, and they usually bring a cold eye for maximizing revenue.
The lawyers, etc., they've made Michael Jackson number one on Forbes' annual dead celebrities list. Yeah, there really is one, with $140 million in earnings. And who gets the profits? Well, the estate lawyer's cut is likely 10% plus. Singers and dancers and record labels earn plenty performing in Vegas and selling his music. Lawyer Mark Rossler says for a complicated estate where he's doing licensing deals, he's in and out of court, trying to stop bootleggers from putting the artist's picture on posters and T-shirts, his cut can be 30% or more. Uncle Sam's not doing bad either. Income from all the music and marketing is taxed at upwards of 40%. Plus, there's estate tax paid on the value of the assets getting passed on. And that means someone's got to guesstimate what old songs and a dead singer's image might be worth years from now. Michael Jackson's executors put his estate's total value at just $7 million when he died. The tax man was not impressed, says lawyer Robert Wood.
And the IRS came in and said, well, no, we think it's over $1 billion.
The IRS now wants $700 million more. Jackson's lawyers say the king of pop wasn't worth much when he died. We made him a superstar again, so we and his heirs should keep the millions he's making now. The case is in tax court. Stay tuned. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This is, of course, one of those segments that doesn't really work without you and your wondering. So please take a minute, go to our website, and tell us what you want to know. And while you're there, check out the rest of the series, I've Always Wondered. It is, repeat after me, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which comes out of St. Louis County, Missouri, as we have been on the air. As we mentioned earlier, a grand jury has brought no criminal charges against Officer Darren Wilson for the shooting of Michael Brown this summer in Ferguson. The announcement by St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough tonight came after a long day of waiting and uncertainty. He is, in point of fact, as we go off the air, still speaking as I speak. The parents of Michael Brown released a statement shortly after the decision was announced that ended with this. It's a quote, "Join with us in our campaign to ensure that every police officer working the streets in this country wears a body camera. We respectfully ask," they went on, "that you please keep your protests peaceful." President Obama is set to make a statement as well from the White House. It'll be after 10 o'clock Washington time, after 7 o'clock back here. That is to say, after we go off the air. We'll have more from Ferguson tomorrow on our slice of this story on the Marketplace Morning Report with my colleague David Brancaccio. And tomorrow afternoon, of course, back here. We're going to leave it there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Stacey Palacio, and Josh Wu. I'm Kai Rizal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Have a good evening. This is APM.